things I've learned over time, have lots of backups. So, okay. So, thanks a lot, everyone. This is sort of weird. This is an unusual view for me, because I'm looking into the room, and of course, I'm looking behind you, from behind you, so I'm actually giving you a talk to the back of your head, and yet you see me facing you in front of you. This is, oh, I wish I could, I probably can. I want to, I'm just going to capture this on the video camera, so, okay. Alright, so I don't know if you can see that on the video camera if you were watching this at some later date, but I gave it a try. Gave it my best shot.
We can see it now.
Okay, for just so that you know what's happening here, and this will, I hope I haven't messed up my settings. This will play a bit of a role in the talk. I've got digital video camera over there, digital audio going here. If you guys have recorders of any sort, feel free to use them. That's the way I prefer it. I also have slides for this talk. They are on my website now. If you have internet access, go to COU2007.ppt. I see someone typing there. And it should be about 1.5 megabytes or 15 megabytes, one or the other. So we'll see if that comes up. It should come up now. I discovered about 5 minutes before my talk began that my website had crashed. So, and now that appears to be a database problem and not a server problem. So it should give you the files, the PowerPoint slides. If not, they'll certainly be available later on. Any joy getting the slides? I'm trying to look at your screen there, but that's pretty wild looking at your screen. So okay, a few of you got the slides. Excellent. So I'll begin to begin a bit more formally. The title of this talk is Collaboration Tools and Web 2.0, and basically what I want to do is cover the concept of collaboration briefly, talk some about the Web 2.0 tools that are available, spend some time looking at the trends that are happening in Web 2.0 technologies right now, and then examine some of the underlying philosophies behind these 2.0 tools and collaboration. I intend to talk for maybe, not necessarily a full hour, but I certainly want to leave some time for discussion and that at the end of the session, although I will point out, or I will say right now, especially since we have this wonderful interactive television happening, if you have comments or questions or anything at any time, do feel free to jump in, interrupt. Some of you, if you wave your hand, I'll be able to see that. It looks like there's more tables here that I can't see at the moment. Those of you who are on the screen, if you have a question, you might as well wave your hand because I can see into the back of your head and I'll see it in your brain there. So, well, how can you prove me wrong? Never mind. I guess with mirrors. So I want to talk a bit first. I do want to emphasize, do feel free to jump in. It very often creates the most interesting part of the presentation when people have comments, ask questions, or challenge the things that I have to say. I want to talk briefly about collaboration. I'm going to begin with a definition from Wikipedia, which I thought was an appropriate place to begin. Collaboration is a process defined by the recursive interaction of knowledge and mutual learning between two or more people who are working together in an intellectual endeavor toward a common goal, which is typically creative in nature. I find that to be a bit of a mouthful. If we look at collaboration, we often see collaboration associated with things like teamwork, we see collaboration associated with a process involved with stages of problem setting, direction setting, structuring. Collaboration is very often associated with the output or the consequence of the process. A collaboration is the result and not just the process. But I think that the main idea of collaboration is the idea of working together, or as Bags and Schmidt say, of sharing, of planning, of making decisions, solving problems, setting goals, assuming responsibility, communicating, and coordinating openly. So the idea here is of people doing things in the same space, more or less in the same way, more or less in the same direction. As these definitions, I'm spending a little bit of time on them at the beginning. I think these definitions are going to be shaken up a bit by the time we get to the end. We have this concept of collaboration, like I say, this concept of collaboration as being like teamwork, like group work. And it's not clear to me that that concept of collaboration that we have going into this whole Web 2.0 process is going to be the same as when we come out of the Web 2.0 process. It's so strange talking at the back of the room. The collaborative process, sort of thought about the different steps, and I thought this was, and again, I'm not trying to define definitively for all time what collaboration is, and you could probably define it, you know, slightly differently one way or another. What I'm trying to do here is simply to set up the framework for the discussion of the Web 2.0 applications. And so in setting up that framework, it seems to me that we can think about collaboration in terms of five steps. Team creation processes, the generation of ideas collaboratively, decision making collaboratively, the actual doing of the work or the production, and then evaluation or recap. So we begin with thinking about team creation. We think, again, in collaboration, I'm looking at something by Katzenbach and Smith, and I'm sure you've seen lots of literature along these lines. We talk about, you know, what group dynamics are, how you need small groups, how you need groups with complementary skills and group members. A lot of talk when we talk about collaboration about having a common purpose for working. Common mechanisms, common ways of doing things, agreed upon performance goals, shared working approaches, shared tools for that matter, and mutual accountability. And so there are these mechanisms, these processes that are, if you will, intentional, that we use to deliberately create groups. And we create groups with a very specific idea in mind, that they are going to be working together, that they're going to be sharing certain properties or certain qualities, that the members will be sharing these properties and qualities. There's a discussion in the literature on collaboration about the sharing of values as well, and how it's important that the people who are collaborating have a common vision or a common goal or a common outlook. Moving on into idea generation, there's a lot of discussion about this on the internet and in the literature, and I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the ways that people can generate ideas collaboratively, things like brainstorming, things like concept mapping or mind mapping, breaking down or analysis of a problem or a situation, storyboarding, role-playing, and so on. There are dozens of these techniques that can be used in order to create ideas in a collaborative environment. Decision making, and we can go everywhere from autocratic, which is mostly my experience of collaboration, you know, the person in charge makes the decision and then everyone else collaborates. But you have autocratic decision making. I read about hand clasping, where two people in the group agree among themselves and then they sort of take the whole rest of the group with them. Or you can have tweaks, three people, four people, in other words, some subgroup of the group who in some way speak for the group. Working a bit more democratically here, we can think of collaborative decision-making processes such as consensus, and there's a whole bunch of There's a lot of discussion, a lot of ways to get groups to work towards consensus, iterative processes, convergent processes where you sort of find common ground and narrow your way toward a consensus. There are deliberative processes, Robert's Rules of Order, for example, ways of conducting discussion, ways of polling, straw polls, and the actual votes and voting mechanisms. All of these, you can sort of see how I've gone through sort of scale of decision-making mechanisms in groups and in collaborations. Work or production, and there's all kinds of things that groups do to do work. I would break it down into four major functions: the execution of the task, the tracking of the execution of the task, the timelining, and the optimization of the execution of the task. There are different ways of organizing this in a number of places. I'm not sure if it's a lot, but a number of places they talk about individuals having specific roles and responsibilities, the dividing up of the tasks. So the collaboration is actually individuals each doing their own thing in a coordinated fashion. Or we can think of the work being done in an iterative fashion. If you think about, for example, the Microsoft Word tracking feature, where one person makes a change, another person makes a change. And then you can even think of people working together in a common environment. And I'm reminded of the film Music and Lyrics, although, of course, it's a very common process, where two people are in a living room working on the same song at the same time and trying to get that to work together. Then finally, we have the evaluation or the recap process in a collaboration. This is essentially a reflecting process. It might be a tabulation of expectations and results. It might be a surveying or a polling process. It might be a scoring or a measurement against objective standards. It might be some process of storytelling, some process of lessons learned, some collection of best practices. So let's a really quick romp through collaboration. I'm sure I haven't told you anything that's particularly new there, but what I wanted to do here is lay out the land. And now that we've got sort of a lay of the land, I'm going to map that onto the Web 2.0 applications. So I want to begin with just thinking about collaboration and collaboration online. And as I was preparing for this talk, I realized that where I wanted to begin is not so much with the Web 2.0 tools, but with the electronic environment itself, because it's a part of an environment that's very frequently lost. I'm sitting here, for example, in a room. I'm all by myself in this room. I'm surrounded by blue walls, as you can sort of see. I have no internet connectivity, which is unfortunate. We're kind of in a transitional period. But I was thinking, as I was preparing for this talk, that there's so many cases where people are expected to collaborate, and the way that they collaborate is they gather in rooms like this with a brown wooden table and no connectivity, no wires, no nothing. They don't even bring their computers. They just sort of bring papers and pencils and whatever. And so, obviously, in that sort of environment, they are not going to be using Web 2.0 tools at all. They're not going to be using any sorts of tools at all. So it seemed to me I wanted to sketch out a list of basic needs. These are fundamental needs that I think underlie any collaborative environment these days. First of all, some sort of computing equipment. Computers, mobile phones, PDAs, something. I was very heartened when I looked at this group here and I saw the computers opened up on the desk there, because it meant that people were going to have their computers open. Others may have, well, I don't know if you're using your mobile phone or not, because some of you are out in the back of the room, so I can't see you if you're texting or something, but mostly you do have the computers there with you. The second thing, and I guess you must have it because you got my slides, the wireless internet connection. You have a wireless connection there? Can anyone tell me? Yes. Is it good?
Yeah.
Awesome. This is one of these...
It's very good.
It's very good. That's funny though. You have to walk to the front of the room to say something. yeah. This is a very unusual setup. I'm having lots of fun with this. I'm expecting him to write a big note or something there at the front. I'm just sort of watching him. And the other thing, and now I'm curious about this, and I actually put this, those of you who are following on the slides can see this is point number 3. Power outlets. How's your power over there?
Good.
Wow. Well, this is much better than I had anticipated. So many places that, well, you bring your own computer, of course, and then sometimes they even remember to provide the wireless internet, and then they forget that computers use power and that you need a plug. What are you looking for?
There we go. I'm trying to move the mic to the audience, so we don't have to keep getting up like this. Let's keep with
you. Okay.
We're in a world here. Hi, Jason. How are you doing?
Pretty good. And then the final thing, and it's probably not the final thing, I'm sure we can think of other things, display screens or monitors. We've got here one monitor, right? If I were God and I were setting this up, I would have given myself internet connection, first of all. But then I would put a second monitor beside the first one. Actually, I'd have 3 monitors up there. You might think that's excessive, but it isn't. For one, well, you need the big center one for me, because, well, I'm here, and if you want to see me, anyhow. The second one, for my slides or any visual aids, those of you who are looking at my slides will see that these slides are really dull, but it's because I knew I wasn't presenting them up on a big screen, so I focused mostly on the content, and they're mainly helping me out as speaking notes. But then the third monitor that I would put up would be a monitor for a back channel of some sort, a way for us to communicate with each other by typing messages. So it might be an instant message screen, it might be an IRC screen, or something like that, a chat room or whatever. So as I'm going along and I'm talking away here, if one of you in the back of the room that I can't see had a comment, you didn't really want to interrupt me or even have me see it necessarily. You just type up whatever you were thinking, and I could see that come up as I was talking. The idea here is having those displays actually increases the communication, and it helps make the session an interactive session. And so these days I'm always sort of thinking of that sort of thing when I'm thinking about using, you know, when I'm thinking about collaboration in a Web 2.0 environment. I'm beginning with the idea of the room itself, a room like you're in, and thinking about how do you make this room not simply a presentation room, and what you've got there is pretty much a presentation room with the desk at the front and the microphones and the big screen and the podium and the ubiquitous flip chart there in the corner. Yeah, it's a presentation room, and what you want more and more is a collaboration room, an interaction room, but that means more monitors, more screens, so you can see more interaction happening. Okay, so what kind of interaction are we talking about here? I'm talking about basic communications. And this is a list that you guys all know already, but I'm going to run through it anyways because I want to get this down as a foundational point. Things like email or mailing lists, things like instant messaging, bulletin boards, discussion boards, telephone, audio chats, meeting, video conferences, presentation tools, document storage and exchange. All of these are ways of getting content back and forth. And in a collaborative environment, you want some of them at least enabled. In a synchronous environment like this, you'll want synchronous communication tools enabled. Things like the instant messaging, which is why I suggest like a chat room or something like that. Things like audio chat or video conference, which is what we're doing here. And in an asynchronous environment, if we were going to be collaborating over a longer period of time, then we're going to want I don't want to say more static necessarily, but more asynchronous communication tools like discussion boards, document storage, things where you put something up and I come along later at my own good time and have a look at it. So, okay, so that's the basic infrastructure. We've got some hardware, wireless, computers, stuff like that in place. We got an idea of these communication tools, this kind of communication environment. Now we enter Web 2.0. And what is Web 2.0? Well, Web 2.0 is at heart a set of core technologies. People talk a lot about Web 2.0. They talk in very vague terms. You may have noticed that. They talk about the web as platform. They may talk about the internet as conversation. And what does that mean more specifically? Well, Web 2.0, when you get right down to it, is a very specific set of applications that creates a range of different uses, of different affordances. The first application is social networking. The concept of social networking is very simple. I am a person, I have a set of friends, I list this set of friends, I communicate with this set of friends. You do the same sort of thing. And if we all do the same sort of thing, then I'm connected to people, you're connected to people, they're connected to people, and it all forms a network. The first social networking applications were things, the instant message programs, things like ICQ. You may remember when ICQ, that was the first of the instant messaging programs, certainly the first that I'm aware of. It came along and you type a message, somebody receives it. But the way it worked was genius in my mind, because you defined a list of what are now called buddies. So the idea is if you wanted to chat with somebody online, you just double-clicked on their name and you were chatting with them online. And that made ICQ pretty unique because each individual person had their own list of buddies. And so each individual person had their own different way of looking at the internet. And this forms the basis for the actual social network applications. The first of those is a site called Friendster. You've probably heard of it. And the idea is that you would log on to Friendster, create a profile, and then you'd select your friends. You'd have your list of Friendster friends. And then along came sites like LinkedIn, and you log on to LinkedIn, you have your list of LinkedIn friends. And then Orkut and Facebook and MySpace and all the rest. One of the earliest ones of these, I think, actually was LiveJournal. LiveJournal is a blogging application, but it was one of the first social networking applications as well, because people who had LiveJournal blogs also had their own LiveJournal friends. People always forget about LiveJournal when we talk about social networking. So the concept here, person-to-person communications, individual lists of connections, and then networks formed out of those individual lists of connections. Okay, so social networking, that's kind of neat. A second major technology, and it's almost an approach more than a technology, that characterizes Web 2.0 is something called tagging. Tagging is what happens if your librarians go on strike. No, I'm just kidding. But I thought that was pretty funny. Basically, the idea behind tagging... Boy, the sound coming from the other side is really delayed, so I make a joke and then I kind of have to wait. And if it's funny, about 5 or 10 seconds later, I'll get some laughter. Like that. I think it's because we're maybe half duplex or something on this line. So as long as I'm speaking, I can't hear you, but if I pause, then that gives you room to talk to me. That's kind of interesting. So I have to remember that, because I very often speak without even pausing for air, much less allowing people to jump in. Anyhow, tagging. Tagging, the name comes from graffiti, where people would just tag something on a wall, and it's about as organized. You have a resource, a photograph and a Flickr, say, and you're looking at that resource and you're asking yourself, well, what does that resource remind me of? And you look at it, it's a picture of a tree, you say, oh, it's a tree, and you write tree. And now you've categorized that picture as tree. Or you might be really good at trees And so you look at that tree and say, well, that's not just a tree, that's an oak. And so you write oak. The point here is, you're not working according to some sort of predefined vocabulary or lexicon or taxonomy. What you are doing is, it's almost free associating. You are picking whatever word you, as an individual, think is appropriate to describe that resource. Where tagging gets neat and interesting is not so much when one person does it, but when you get a whole group of people doing it. Because, not surprisingly, when a bunch of people look at things, like say a tree, they will typically come up with the same word for it. Take 10 people, have them look at a tree, 10 of them will say it's a tree. 5 of them will say it's an oak, and only one of them will say it's the old oak or whatever. The idea here is that you get clusters of words associated with specific resources, and sometimes these clusters are unexpected, unanticipated. If I put my website out in front of you and asked you to tag my website, who knows what you would come up with? And the thing is, if I had a large enough group tagging something like a website, especially something as undefined as my own website, we might get some very interesting things, unexpected things. Probably a lot of you would tag it as Stephen Downs, I would hope anyways, but who knows what other people would tag it as. So this bringing together of, how do I want to describe it? I don't want to say user-defined input, although that's kind of what it is. But this free-form input that people do without any particular rules, bringing that together is an important part of Web 2.0. It's the creation of a structure out of a lack of structure. And you see tagging or something similar to tagging deployed across Web 2.0 applications. You have things like Delicious, which very specifically are tagging of web resources, or Flickr, which enables the tagging of photographs and tagging for all manner of resources in all other Web 2.0 applications. Oh, this is interesting. Okay, so as I said before, I'm looking at the back of your head, and so I'm seeing the bottom of the screen in front of me, and I have two screens in front of me. On the left, I have the video screen where I'm seeing that room that I just described. On the right, I have a television which shows my own image, and of course there's a delay. So I move like this, I see it right away on the right, and about a second later on the left, which is interesting. You see why they say turn your radio down, because it's sort of the visual equivalent of that. So I am really easily distracted. You may have noticed that. All right. The next thing that is essential, this is almost the core, the heart of Web 2.0, is something called AJAX, Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. And what that is it's a nifty little technology. It's actually built into JavaScript. So really, it's just JavaScript, right? And it doesn't actually always involve XML, so it's a bit misnamed. But what it is you have a web page in front of you, and you remember you used to, you know, say you were logging into a site, or say you were entering data or something like that, and you'd fill in a form, you'd hit submit, and the whole page would reload, right? Well, what AJAX does is it does away with this whole page reloading thing. So what you have is, you have your web page, you have a little window that's created by the JavaScript, and then you fill in your data and you hit submit, and it simply reloads that little window. The page stays there. What AJAX is a way for a web page to make a request to a web server and get data back without having to reload. Now, the limitation of AJAX is that the server that it gets data from has to be the same server that you got the original page from. Now, this is a long-standing restriction in the way browsers and HTML work, where it's a security condition, right? A security requirement, so that one website can't read data that's being transferred from another website to a user. So website, you know, you can only interact with one website at a time. So the AJAX will only send a request back to the place that sent you the page to begin with. But still, you can do an awful lot of that, because it means now that you can be putting data in back and forth, without having to reload the page. Well, it's a lot faster, especially if you have broadband. It's like almost instantaneous. But it's a much more pleasant user experience, because you're not sitting there waiting for the page to reload. And I'm sure you've seen these things with these pages where you enter in some data, and it's like enter a rating or something like that. You click the button, it just says, you know, and it just says thank you and displays the total or something like that. It seems like a minor technology, but you can use it to create very, very interactive web pages. Related to that and connected to that, and also at the heart of Web 2.0, is something called representational state transfer, or REST. And you've probably all heard of web services, right? And what web services are basically is a way for one website to be able to talk to another website in order to conduct some sort of transaction. And you've certainly heard or perhaps seen demonstrations of the canonical web services demonstration where a person is trying to make a reservation to go traveling somewhere, and they have the travel agent website using web services to connect to the airline, the car rental, the hotel, the restaurant, whatever. And the idea here is that with web services, one website can actually obtain information or perform functions on another website. But the thing with web services is they involve a lot of overhead. They require a very precise defining of the resources. They're kind of slow. They require registries to look up where the web service is, what the functions are that it offers. What REST is essentially web services on the cheap. And basically, it is the representation of a set of data as a URL. And what that means is that one web server can access data or perform a function on another web server simply by sending information to a URL. So it's still a way for these services to work together, but it's done much more on the fly. It's much more loose than the whole web services approach, which means ultimately that it's a lot easier to code, it's a lot easier to create, you can do it with simple scripting language, and so you can get a lot of them fast and very cheap. You may have seen these programs that do things like mash up Flickr photos. You maybe create, do something with a Flickr photo, put it on a map or something like that. These programs are using REST to get information about the Flickr photo and information about the map back and forth. So what you have now, if you sort of begin to see the whole picture, right? You've got web pages that can have ongoing conversations with web servers that can talk to each other, and so now you've got this whole kind of environment happening here where you haven't reloaded a page, but you're just sitting there working with that page, and there's data going back and forth and back and forth. And that's how you get the next major aspects of Web 2.0, something called the Application Program Interface, API, and mashups. And again, the API is simply, it's like the code to access information or to perform functions on a web server. For example, if you wanted to upload a post to Blogger, there's going to be an application program interface, an API created by Blogger that tells somebody else how to put a post into Blogger. So I'm sitting here on my own website and I'm writing computer code, blah, 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 computer code, computer code. And I can create on my website a little box so that when I hit submit, the content goes into Blogger, which is run by Google, and puts a post up on my Blogger blog. And if you take these things and you put them together in interesting ways, you get what's known as a mashup. And a mashup is simply two or more applications working together to produce something unexpected. Blog posts on Google Maps, for example. I'm just trying to think of some of this blog post, or, you know, Google Maps. Most of the mashups seem to involve Google Maps because that seems to be the most useful thing. But I'm trying to think of others. I can't think of any offhand. But you can imagine, take any two programs that you know. There's actually a mashup generating algorithm out there. Take any two programs you know. Imagine in your own mind what it would be like if they were mixed together. Google News and Google Maps. Picture that. Well, that would be a mashup, right? It's a map of little news things popping up on it or something like that. Google News and Flickr. Yeah, maybe. I found this really neat application. It was one of the videos that was shown at the TED conference, in fact. What they did is they took images from Flickr and they created three-dimensional representations of actual buildings from all the photographs in Flickr. So you can just imagine this. You're looking at this three-dimensional representation of, say, St. Paul's Cathedral, and it has actually been built from the photographs that thousands of different people took from different angles of that building. Okay. One more. Essential element of Web 2.0 is something called JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. And that sounds like a mouthful, but it really isn't. It's actually very simple. What JSON is data coded as though it were JavaScript commands. And a JavaScript command might look like A equals some value. And the thing is, you can have arrays of data and you can have associative arrays or hashes of data. In other words, you can have data structures. And these are created in a very specific way in Java. And the thing is, if you create a data array in Java, and if you put this data array on your website, just plain, or not Java, JavaScript, I should say. And so you just have this chunk of JavaScript code sitting there as a file all by itself on your website. Another web page can come along and grab that data and execute that as JavaScript within that page. So think about that for a second. I have some numerical data, say maybe just all my students' grades. I wouldn't do this really, but just for the sake of argument. So it's all my students' grades. You know, Jamie, 86. Fred, 92. Sally, 38. Whatever. All my grades, right? So I just represent them in this little bit of JavaScript code. I put that on my website. And then, the university accesses that from my website and runs that as a bit of JavaScript code and then creates a little graph on their page or submits them into a routine or something. The thing about JSON is not only is it a way for me to present data that other people can use, it solves the cross-domain problem. This is huge. This is much more huge than you can possibly imagine. Maybe you can imagine it, I'm sorry, but it's more huge than I can imagine because people were looking for this for ages. If I put this data on my website, you can use this data on your website as though it were JavaScript code. So, normally we think of numerical data, but you could use it to Well, the way I used it to list all the referrers to from one web page to another page is one thing I did. Another thing I did is I created an array that defined a style sheet, and then I used the same style sheet on my website and on Blogger and on other sites. I had the same style sheet working in all of these different sites, such that when I changed the number just one digit on my site, it reflected or changed on all of these other sites. So it was it's the cross-domain styling problem solved. It's known as the tag hack, interestingly enough. And the people who first used it in any major way were advertisers. But now this is being used to transmit content from one website to another website. And again, it helps create these mashups. So those are the technologies that underlie Web 2.0. Those are the things that make Web 2.0 happen. And then, out of that, what we get are the lists of applications that we typically associate with Web 2.0. But let me just pause here, as I'm about to blast a bunch of apps at you, and I don't want to just launch into that. So let's see if, I just want to pause here and see if everybody's good with where I am so far, see if there's any comments or questions. Am I going too fast or too slow?
Hold on a sec. Yep. I'm watching it like I'm no longer non-state back of the room, so I'm looking at the camera. Now, like you, I can't see anything. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about why this latest Web 2.0 tool was solving a pre-existing problem. Not entirely sure what the pre-existing problem that required this,
along
with the long-standing problem was.
Sure.
I'm Peter Lapp, by the way. Nice to see you in the
browser.
They are here.
I should. Oh, I guess I can't. I was going to say I should show you the forest. Anyhow, remember learning objects?
Yeah.
They're still kind of a going concern, but. One of the things with learning objects was, the whole idea with a learning object was, you build it here, all right, and it might even be stored here, but then you use it here. And the problem was that the learning object wouldn't work with the learning management system unless they were both on the same machine. And that's this cross-domain problem. Because unless they were both on the same machine, the learning management system could not send data to the learning object. Just couldn't do it. The browser wouldn't let it do it. It would try to access it, and the code would do nothing. It would be like nothing happened. And similarly, the learning object couldn't provide data to the learning management system. But you wanted this to happen, right? Because you wanted to be able to do things like style the learning object. So you've got the learning management system for Mega University here, and Mega University, because they're Mega University, they want megauniversity.com at the top of all of their web pages. They're very image conscious. Well, so now when a student accesses the learning object, Mega University wants megauniversity.com to be on the top of that learning object. This whole branding thing, right? But unless the learning object is on the same server as in the same domain, I should say more accurately, as the learning management system, the LMS cannot send that branding information to the learning object. The learning object will simply ignore it. Similarly, it can't send background, it can't send any information about the students, no student-specific information. It can't send any state information, such as, what modules the student's already done, student background information, what course this is, and so on. And so learning management systems, the way that whole thing got developed was that you ended up with a learning content management system, an LCMS, and basically you'd buy your learning objects and you'd bring them all to you, and then everything would be served off of the institutional learning management system, and then you could get all these nice state transfers and that. So that's the thing that Jason solves. And what's significant about that is I don't need to send you the learning object anymore, and you don't need to store it in your learning management system. If I have a nifty learning object, and I know that you have an LMS that can use JSON, in other words, a Web 2.0 enabled LMS, then I know that I can serve my learning object right off of my own website, and you access it when you need it. So it means that my learning object can be right up to date. It's not a static content object anymore, but it can be something that reflects, say, yesterday's stock prices or yesterday's weather or whatever. It means that I can change the content of the learning object at any time. It means that we can have an environment that actually stretches beyond or reaches outside of the institutional LMS. So does that answer that question? It's the cross-domain problem is certainly a problem for learning management systems.
Thank you. Just walking back to Cameron, play the old video conferencing etiquette. Thanks, that's good. I just have a question about, just as you described some of these technologies, it strikes me as that a lot of them are workaround solutions. And is it really Web 2.0 we're talking about, or Web 1.5? Or I guess another way to say that is, when is Web 3.0 coming out, which will take care of a lot of these inherent limitations?
Yeah. We might not ever see Web 3 in that sense. I mean, there's been lots of discussion as to what Web 3.0 really is. Some people, a fair number of people, have actually said, well, Web 3.0, that actually is the semantic web, properly so called. Other people say, no, Web 3.0 is actually going to be Web 3D. And it's going to be full multimedia, and I don't see it as going into the full blown semantic web. I don't see the web becoming Second Life either, or anything like that. So I think a lot of these workarounds are going to be the way things are done from now on. Odd as that sounds, I think that it's like JSON, for example, right? JSON is a hack. It's completely and totally a hack. It's nothing but a hack. But it's a good hack. It works really well. It's really limited in its scope, which means that with some attention, the people who write browsers can, make sure that it's not a great big gaping security hole. It's kind of a security hole as it is, because you're flinging data around. But if you're attentive to the fact that you're flinging data around, you can manage it. And JSON and the tag hack and all of that aren't going to be removed from browsers, because if they were, the web advertising market, the bottom would drop out of it, because all these ways that advertisers have of passing data and tracking where you go and all of that depend on things like the tag hack and little web bugs and little bits of JavaScript that we never even see. So I think that's, in a certain real sense, that's where, that's going to be it. I'm going to talk a little bit later about another major element of Web 2.0, which is RSS, and I'm sure you've all heard of RSS. And RSS, again, is another hack. Here's the semantic web, which is this great, big, wonderful construction, beautifully designed. Should have worked. Would have worked if people got along together. And then we have RSS, which is this, you know, quick, cheap, dirty XML hack, which works really well for, again, a fairly narrow purpose. We're not going to get rid of RSS either. People have tried. They've tried to replace it with all kinds of things. But RSS works. RSS, you know, whatever Web 3.0 is, it'll assume RSS in the background somehow, or completely replace it. But I just don't see what would replace it. So I think the lesson here is that whatever web, when Web 3.0 comes along, it's going to be a hack. It's going to be, you know, it'll be something that was just put together, you know, by somebody to solve a specific problem, whatever this is, and people will realize, oh, wow, and you can also do that and that and that and that. And, you know, it'll be a mixture, I think, maybe more semantic, maybe, well, I don't think it'll even be called Web 3.0. I think it'll be something completely different. It'll be like V-Web or whatever, you know. It'll have its completely own, its own name. I think it'll probably be some sort of semantically enabled 3D kind of neat thing that fits into your goggles and you use it to drive your car or whatever. But, you know, it's kind of hard to predict exactly what it's going to look like. But it's not going to be the semantic web. It's not going to be Second Life. There's not going to be any of these things that we can plan on. And it's not really going to be anything current for another couple of years, 2 or 3 years down the line. Once everyone's learned Web 2.0 and AJAX and REST and all of that stuff, and everybody's really comfortable with that, that's when all of that will be obsolete, as usual.
Thanks, Peter.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have a clock here. 157. So, oh, that's your 157, isn't it? I think. I have a clock, but I know it's wrong. But which way is it wrong?
Yeah, it's 157 for us.
Right, and we continue, I'm sorry, until I believe 2:30?
I believe so.
Okay. Or 2:45, one or the other. Okay, anyhow. Right.
2:45.
Okay, so we're doing good because we're about halfway. Perfect. Okay, let's sort back up here then. I hope you're all finding this interesting. All right. I'm just going to zip through, and again, those of you who have access to the slides, you can see the websites there for many of these things, and those of you who don't have access, you'll be able to, I hope, get this off of my website after the session. So, again, I'm going to go through these stages from before, like team creation, idea generation, and the like. And we've got quite a number of Web 2.0 applications for team creation. I think the original applications, well, beyond groupware, are things like Yahoo Groups and Google Groups. And, you know, these are two sites that are very often underrated or underrepresented when people talk about Web 2 or even the web generally. But there's a huge amount of activity, a huge amount of group formation activity that happens on these two websites. Also, content management systems and learning management systems all have their own built-in mechanisms for creating groups of users, either specifically named groups or sometimes groups defined as roles. When we're looking at Web 2.0 in particular, oh, I'm distracting myself with my motion delay again. I've got to watch what I do with my hands because it catches out of the corner of my eye. Then we're looking at the social networks that I listed earlier, things like Friendster, LinkedIn, Orkut, MySpace, Facebook, and so on. All of those social networks have a mechanism whereby you can create a group. And there are some social networks that are specifically designed for the creation of groups online. Sites like Ning, again, is a social network application where the basic unit of organization in Ning is the group rather than the application itself. And another one is ELGG. Okay, so you've got teams created, you've got ways of communicating with each other, therefore in these social networks. The next thing is to generate ideas. Web 2.0 has all kinds of idea generating applications. There are brainstorming tools, and there's I've got a link there to the online education database, which actually links to four or five separate brainstorming applications. Research and tracking of ideas are really important. So I talked about tagging when I talked about Web 2.0. Using tagging in the context of a research or tracking application is a very potent way of creating unexpected associations between things. Delicious. I put the wrong URL there. If you're looking at my slides, it's not www.delicious. It's simply del.icio.us, which is, I always want to pronounce it delicious because of the place where the dots are, but nobody pronounces it that way except me. But basically what that is it's a social bookmarking application. So again, it has these social networking features built in. You can create your list of friends and things like that. But what you're doing basically is you're tagging bookmarks. So you go to a website and you have a delicious toolbar that gets embedded into your browser. So you go to a website, you say, oh, I want to keep this website. You click on the little delicious button. It pops up a little form. You enter in a tag, so you can tag the site. You hit submit. Now you've got a record of that site, plus a little tag that tells you something about it. And the thing is, you have your bookmarks, but your bookmarks and Delicious go into this pool with all the bookmarks of other people. So you can either have your own a group of people who are looking at each other's Delicious bookmarks, or you can have the entire world's Delicious bookmarks on a certain subject. I find it really neat because I'm sort of at the other end of this. I don't use Delicious a whole lot personally, but every once in a while one of my resources will be tagged by people in Delicious. So I'll see this, and what I can do is I can say, well, who are the people who have tagged my resource? It might be one of my papers, say, and I get the list of all the different people who've tagged my resource, and then I can look at their list of resources and see what else they're reading. So this person read my paper on authentication, and they're reading this, this, and this, and this, and all of that's related to authentication. And so it adds all kinds of context and extra information based on their reading of my paper. It's a really easy way, well, not necessarily easy, it's a really effective way of finding new resources directly related to things that I've written about. Related to that is the RSS reader, and I talked a little bit about RSS. Does everyone in this room know what RSS is? Do I need to explain that or not? I can see four people. I need to explain it? Okay, because I see four people and 2 feet and an elbow. So. And
we weren't clear if we were putting our hand up to say that we did or didn't know it.
Yeah. Okay. RSS, when I create, say, a blog post, and it's just a simple simple article that goes on the web. Think of it as like a newspaper article.
Stephen?
Yes.
Stephen?
Yeah.
I think you do know it. I did a miscount with the hand thing, so I think we're all okay with what it is.
All right. Excellent. Then if you know what RSS is, you know what an RSS reader is, and so I can simply say something like, using my RSS reader is a very good way of tracking the discussion and the debate that's taking place in specific areas. One of the things I do want to talk about ever so briefly with respect to RSS is, traditionally, people subscribe to individual RSS feeds. So you subscribe to Jacob Nielsen, you subscribe to Dave Weiner, you subscribe to Tim Bray, you subscribe to Wired, etc. One of the things that is beginning to change is that instead of subscribing to specific people, you can subscribe to feeds that are on specific topics. This is what you're doing, in fact, if you're subscribing to a delicious RSS feed, so you have people tagging these resources, and you can subscribe to a feed associated with that tag, which is pretty handy. And now you just have this constant influx of resources coming into you through your RSS feed. I have a service that I've created, which when my website is working, it's usually working. It should be working right now, but I'm not positive, so I can't say for sure. But basically, it's something called EduRSS. The name of this will be changing shortly, but right now it's called EduRSS. And what I do is I aggregate the feeds of 300 or so edu bloggers, and then I analyze the contents of those feeds as they come in for different topics. So one of the topics that might be, for example, learning objects. So every resource, every post by every person, 300 and so people, I check and see if it has anything to do with learning objects. And if it has something to do with learning objects, I send it to a very specific learning objects feed. And you can subscribe to different EduRSS feeds on my website even now. So, you know, EduBloggers, media, cyberculture, things like that. So I have topic-specific RSS feeds. And I think that this is going to become more prevalent in the future because the way things are going, there's more and more people creating resources and creating feeds online, and it's difficult to find resources from authors you don't know about. And the way to solve that problem is instead of subscribing to authors, you subscribe to topics. Other ways of creating ideas, I talked about concept mapping and mind mapping. There's a whole bunch of tools, Web 2.0 enabled tools. They're visual tools, and they let you draw pictures and things like that. Bubbleus, for example, or flowchart.com. One that I like a lot is called Gliffy, Gliffy.com. And again, it lets me create flowcharts. And you don't need to be a good artist. That's why I really like it. It has all of these predefined shapes, and you just drag the shape and drag arrows to the shapes and put little text in, and then of course because it's all JavaScript and Ajax and all of that, it saves your diagram right there on the website, so you're working interactively with it. Storyboarding and works the same sort of way. A very popular Web 2.0 application is Web Comics, where you can use these tools to create your own comic strip, either with actual pictures that you put speech bubbles on, or actual comics with cartoon characters. So there's mainada.net/comics, for example, or QuickToons. These, again, are on the slides, so you'll be able to access these after. And so on, and I can continue on, and I can talk for the rest of the day just simply listing the names of Web 2.0 applications that help you create things. So we'll move on now to decision making, and it's here that we're going to see the first sort of real cleave between collaboration as we've always understood it and collaboration as it happens online. In the world of Web 2.0, and typically, well, you wouldn't need to make decisions properly, so call people who did whatever they wanted to do. You wanted to create a blog post, you created a blog post. You wanted to comment on something, you commented on something. But one of the things that happened online is that sites like Slashdot became incredibly popular. The internet reaches everyone, or reaches everyone with an internet connection, which is about 1 billion people now, which means that on any given topic you can get 1 billion comments from 1 billion different people. And so you have a site like Slashdot, which is based on the contributions of people, and the question becomes, well, what do you put on the screen? Because you just can't put everything on the screen. They say there's no shortage of real estate on the web, but there is. There is when, you know, you have a certain amount of bandwidth, a certain amount of time it takes to view something, a certain amount of scrolling that you have to do, even choosing, you know, what's going to be the top item on the screen. So Slashdot was one of the very first to begin experimenting with different decision-making processes, and they didn't, you know, you would expect, you know, well, one of the things a lot of sites did, you know, the person who owned the site would make the call, and, well, this will go on the top, this will be next, but, you know, Slashdot was much more community-oriented, and so they developed a rating system whereby the people who contributed comments could rate other comments, and the comments that were most rated would move up higher, and the comments that were less rated would move down lower. And so you got this Slashdot model of this, and you got not just comments being rated, but you also got individuals who contribute comments being rated, so that one person's rating might count as more than somebody else's rating. So the decision-making process involved not just votes, but it involved individual reputations. And you combine this in with what is sometimes called collective wisdom, and the archetypical instance of this today on the web is a website called Dig. I'm not sure, you've probably heard of Dig, but what Dig is a website people contribute stories, and then people either dig it or they don't dig it. Notice how I'm using the visual element here. That's actually what the little icons look like on the website. And the articles with the most digs, they rise to the top of the website, and the articles with the fewest digs drop off the bottom of the website. There's actually quite a few sites that are set up like that. In Canada, here, there's a website called Progressive Bloggers that does the same sort of thing. It's kind of neat because Dig is, you know, you have, I don't know, a gazillion people moving these things up and down, and then, you know, so you have the story, and then you have hundreds of comments following the story. It becomes all very sort of cumbersome. But with a site like Progressive Bloggers, there's a lot fewer people moving these things up and down, which means, of course, they're easier to game, easier to manipulate. But on the other hand, when they're not being manipulated, they work a bit more smoothly. They're not so obtrusive on your browser. They don't take so long to load. They're a lot more snappy. But the idea here is that decisions are being made not so much by votes, and I think it would be a bit of a stretch to say that this is a vote, that a dig for a site is a vote one way or another, but rather by individual assessments of quality or individual decisions. It's kind of like the way decision making works on Google. Google faces the same problem that Dig does. Google needs to return a list of results when somebody submits a search, and the question is, well, how do you do it? And the old way of doing it was the way Yahoo did it. And the way Yahoo did it is they had a whole bunch of indexers, and they indexed everything. And it took forever, and it wasn't really very reliable, and it was expensive. And the way Google does it, as I guess is now by now common lore, is they look at how many other sites have linked to the resource in question. So you're doing a search, you search for Elvis, so you're matching the string Elvis, but now you're, you know, all kinds of sites have Elvis in them. Which site goes to the top? Well, it's the site that the most other sites link to. Well, except you can't just do that. You can't just count links, because you get people who create sites specifically for linking. They're called link farms. So you actually have to look at the credibility of the site. So a very credible site, like say mine, linking to a site that says Elvis, that'll push it up. But if it's just, you know, a site that somebody's created simply for the purpose of linking to the site, then that won't carry so much weight. So now you've got this more complicated formula here of links plus the Google rank or the page rank, the credibility, in other words, of the site doing the linking. And then there are going to be, you know, other considerations as well taken into account to determine how you weigh this. So again, it's not pure voting anymore, but rather it's a combination of all of these autonomous actions. Probably the most extreme case of this is a website like Wikipedia. Wikipedia, there's no voting at all, really. In the case of Wikipedia, each person simply contributes what they think should the content should be, and the content ends up being whatever is there after that process. And what tends to happen is somebody puts in some content, somebody else corrects it and adds some more, somebody else corrects it, and people keep correcting it until the content settles into a version that nobody feels needs any more correcting. And it's almost like an annealing process where, you know, you can imagine the content swinging back and forth between sides until it settles on a wording that everyone would find acceptable. That's the theory in any case, but again, this is the sort of thing, it won't work so well with just a few people, because, you know, the people, for one thing, they find no reason to settle, and for another thing, if you have, say, 12 people and 200 subjects, you just have way too many subjects per people, and you end up with just one person putting something, maybe, into a wiki page. Something like a wiki requires, as Wikipedia has, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people putting in content and corrections all the time. Otherwise, you don't get this settling out effect. If you only have 12 people, your content might end up here, or it might end up here. Just, there's no back and forth happening. But again, you can sort of see, I think, that because these sites are a lot more interactive, and because they take into account multiple variables, the manner of decision making begins to change. Decision making in an online environment, I think, works very differently from decision making in a group environment where there are people around the table going yes and no and having their votes and their discussions back and forth. At least that would be my view on this. The next step in the collaborative process is the actual work or the production, and for me that is crystallized with an application called Writely, which has now become Google Docs, and basically the idea here, because of the description of Web 2.0 that I've given you already, you can almost picture in your mind how this works. It used to be that one person worked on one document at a time. But now, because we can have this a web page exchanging information with a server without reloading, you can have changes being made instantly. So I open up a document, let's say. Basically what that means is I open up a web form which has content, and we'll call the contents of that content the document, and then I start making changes. I type something into that document. Well, the way JavaScript works, JavaScript can pick up individual keystrokes. There's an actual JavaScript method. I think it's like on key press or whatever it is. I'd have to look it up. But basically, anytime I type something into that document, JavaScript goes, oh. And what I can set that script up to do is when I type something, I make a keystroke into that document, I can use AJAX and send that keystroke into the server. Well, great. Now the server's got the keystroke, which means if somebody else has the same document open in front of them, I can use my server to send that keystroke back up, which means you and I can be working on exactly the same document on our computer screen. You have it open on your screen, I have it open on my screen. You can be there in Toronto, I can be here in Moncton. I type my name in the document here, you see it appear there. What that means is the two of us can work on the same document at exactly the same time in the same place, even though we're wherever. All we have to be is online, any one of these Web 2.0 enabled environments. And of course, it doesn't need to just be a text document. That's the easiest and the first. But now we can use things like whiteboards and all of that. And I'm sure you've all seen even the higher level applications like Illuminate and Centra and that, that have these whiteboard applications where one person draws on the whiteboard and everybody else sees it. That is what's now available in web pages as well. There are Web 2.0 whiteboard applications where I draw and you can see and we can both work at the same time. I'll talk briefly about Second Life in a little bit, but Second Life enables, again, the same sort of collaborative environmental manipulation where you and I can be in Second Life. We can be online in this 3D environment and you can make a change on the object and then I can make the change on the object and we're working on exactly the same object in Second Life. Finally, the evaluation or the recap stage, which is essentially a reflection stage. This is actually, I think, the part of Web 2.0 which gets the most attention, because reflecting is the part where we're thinking out loud, if you will. Reflecting, therefore, is the part where we're typing up blog posts or we're creating articles online or even doing things like creating articles in Wikipedia, where we're doing things like collecting best practices, any sort of content capturing and producing process can count as part of the evaluation and recap process. As well, any of these voting online, I'm trying to think of a Web 2.0 voting system off the top of my head. I wish I had the internet connection here because I forgot to put it in the slides. And if I had internet here, I'd just do it on the side and it would pop up and then I'd see it. But I don't have internet here, so I can't remember it off the top of my head. So, again, I've mentioned a few of these names, but if you actually would cover this slide presentation and follow some of the links on this, there are hundreds and hundreds of Web 2.0 applications that are inherently collaborative, communicative, they mash each other up, they do all kinds of things. I didn't even mention things like calendar applications, and there are Web 2.0 calendar applications. And again, they're the same sort of thing, right? You work collaboratively on a calendar. You enter in your calendar information, it pops up on someone else's calendar. But again, follow some of those links there. I actually mentioned it. The online education database list is actually quite a good list of Web 2.0 applications, and there are others as well. I want to talk, well, first I want to check and see how I'm doing on time here. 2:23, okay. Oh, that's good, that's not bad. Let me pause for a second, see if there are any comments or questions at this point.
Do you have comments, questions? Hi, this is Andrew McAllister from the Ontario College of Art and Design, and this is an anecdote question. I think of both places, I don't know where to look. So the other morning I changed my Facebook profile to say that I was married, and somebody wrote on my wall and said, "You got married at 7:45 in the morning, congratulations." And I wanted to, perhaps you could make mention of, because you were talking about Dig and Facebook and some of these other tools, and I think that, you know, there are tremendous educational possibilities for them, that they're far more advanced than some of our siloed content management systems. However, I have grave concerns about things like privacy and the kinds of, the marriage example, I'm constantly having to be very conscious about how I moderate my online presence. Like, for instance, there's things that I wouldn't want any of my colleagues to know about me, or I keep to a smaller group of colleagues, whereas, you know, I'm in the OCAC community, so there are students and faculty, and I have to be, so there's an interesting kind of, I'm moderating my own avatar that's out there, that is my Facebook profile, but at the same time, you know, what's the educational, how does one navigate through that, that sort of quagmire? Don't feel the need to actually answer that.
I don't know. It's a good point, and some of these trends we'll talk about it in the next section. But yeah, privacy and security, especially. I don't really talk about that specifically, though. Maybe I should have. I mean, there's two things that are going to happen, right? On the one hand, it's harder and harder to maintain our privacy. And so we have to be more attentive to that, which means we have to be attentive to what we put in Facebook and understand that what gets put in Facebook doesn't stay in Facebook. On the other hand, and this has been fairly widely documented, attitudes toward privacy are beginning to change. And people are behaving as though they expect that they're living their lives in public. And that shouldn't be as surprising as it sounds. For me, I have an anecdote. I grew up in a small town. In fact, I grew up in a small town in Ontario called Metcalfe, Ontario, which when I lived there had a population of about 500 people and as many cats and dogs. And privacy? There was no privacy. Everyone knew what everyone was doing there. And so, you know, 30 years later or whatever, here I am, I'm on the internet, and I'm sort of like, privacy? What privacy? Everyone knows what I'm doing. And so I think that you can grow up and just sort of be in an environment where things that used to be private aren't necessarily going to be private. If you get married at 7:15 a.m., everybody in the world knows that you're married at 7:15 a.m. Or if you're just creating your Facebook account and you have just now put in that you're married, again, that's going to show up. And people just sort of, you know, whatever, life goes on. So, you know, you see these articles, and I'm sure you've seen them like in the Chronicle or wherever, so-and-so put something in their Facebook account and they're worried now that 20 years later they'll be fired from a job, or they actually have been fired from a job or whatever. And, you know, again, there's the two sides to it. On the one hand, there's the side, you know, don't do the stupid behavior. We had a person came in, give a talk here in Moncton not too long ago and said, well, if you hand in a resume that says you only had one employer, and then you say in your Facebook account that you had four employers and you didn't like any of them, you might get caught. My advice is don't hand in the false resume. What we say in public is going to have to actually be in the future more true. And so that's one of these things that people have to begin to get used to. On the other hand, you know, there's this whole architectures of control thing, and you know, when a technology is developed that invades privacy, people develop ways of getting their privacy anyways. Again, in this conference that I was at just a couple weeks ago, they talked about the proliferation of security cameras, and of course nobody, you know, everybody, especially in Europe, they say, well, security cameras, what are you going to do? They always know where you are. And so they start doing things like, well, wearing hoodies and things like that. But I was thinking about that because, well, you know, we don't have the security cameras in this country, but what we do have are these speeding cameras and these red light cameras. I'm sure you've seen them, or you probably have them there, right? Do you have them in Toronto, or the highway cameras? No? I had them in Edmonton when I lived in Edmonton. Basically, there's a freeway in Edmonton, and they just mount the camera above the freeway, and it's pointed down, and it clocks the car, and if the car is speeding, it takes a picture of the car, and therefore the license plate, right, and then automatically sends a ticket to the owner of the car. And they also do these on red lights, right? They're red light cameras. They're mounted on top of the red light. And if you run a red light, it takes a picture of the car and automatically sends you a ticket. Do you have those there? Yeah. So,
yes, we do.
I thought about that. And if you go out and you look, you'll see that more and more, there's a couple things that are happening. One thing that's happening, people are putting covers, plastic covers, over their license plates. And those are kind of neat, because when you look at them straight on, you can see the license plate no problem, but they're opaque to the cameras. The other thing I saw, this is on the racing, or the, you know, the sports cars, the coupes or whatever, and the back of the car comes down, and then there's a little ridge, and then it goes down, so it's sort of like a ridge like that, and that's where the license plate is. So again, there's this protective thing so that the red light camera or the speeding camera doesn't see the license plate. The police car here or another driver can see the license plate, but there's this little ridge. And if you look for that, you see people are doing these little innocuous things to protect their license plates from being seen by these cameras. You know, legal things are just, you know, at the edge of legality. And so I think that the lesson to be drawn from that is that, you know, there's a push and a flow, and there's going to be a back and forth. Our attitudes will adjust, but also, you know, like, people are ornery. Well, comply. They don't just go with the flow. If their lives are being exposed on Facebook, they change their lives, or, you know, I mean, me, I would start, you know, if I was really worried about it, I'd start throwing false data out there. You know, my life's on Facebook and it's going to get me in trouble. Well, I'm going to put many lives on Facebook. I'll put so much stuff on Facebook. I'll talk about the shark attack and my career as a pirate and the time I was in the war. You know what I mean? So, and people play with their identities. And, you know, people, and this is the importance of the work that Dana Boyd is doing. Identity isn't something that you're stuck with anymore. You know, and your data about you isn't something that is done to you anymore. Not nearly as much as it is, as it was. You know, and people are much freer to create what it is that they are, rather than be given what it is that they are. I'm not expressing that as well as I would like, but, you know, it's like you described the force, the push against privacy, and push against privacy. The problem with it isn't so much the exposure, it's the loss of control. It's, you know, it's not so much, you know, who cares if your boss knows that you're a communist. The problem is if your boss fires you because you're a communist, right? It's the control thing. So if you can push back the control, if you take back the control, then the loss of privacy doesn't matter so much. And so I think we see that. I think we see people playing with control of information, playing with that flow of information. I think we'll see more of that in the future. We'll see, you know, deceptive profiles. Not deceptive in the sense of being fraudulent, but deceptive in the sense of, you know, just kind of a smokescreen kind of, you know, the information's out there. Well, let's just muddy the waters a bit. It seems to be the logical way to go.
Stephen,
yeah.
I kind of jumped ahead in counting the number of slides you have, and you have 20 odd left. I'd like to know what you'd like to do from here. Would you like to keep just chatting and have it in the last 10 minutes, or do you actually want to focus on a couple key slides before we move into another kind of discussion level, or what's your preference here?
Let me just outline the trends briefly. And then I'll spend about 2 minutes talking about the last 20 slides. There's the last set of slides there is on the philosophy, and I can cover the philosophy very quickly without having to go through all the slides. That's why it's better when I just have the slides and you don't know what they are. No, I'm just kidding. All right, but yeah, I do want to identify these trends, because I think these trends are important. First trend everybody knows about, but I need to identify it anyways for completeness, and that's the trend towards user-generated content. And we are seeing, as a result of the much greater capacities that people now have to produce high quality content, that they are in fact producing high quality content or even low quality content. What's undeniable is that they're producing piles of it, and that this content is in large part becoming a challenge to, and even in some cases replacing, traditional professional or authority driven content. The classic example, of course, is Wikipedia versus Encyclopedia Britannica. But I mean, we're seeing the news media world has been just completely rocked by the internet because of the impact of individual blogging and what they're calling citizen media or citizen journalism. It's having a huge impact on professional journalism. Or people talking about YouTube replacing television. And it's kind of funny because I sit there in my living room, my computer's here, my television's here, I've got, I don't know, American Idol here, and I don't know, something else here, British American Idol here, whatever, you know what I mean. And you know, my attention is today, like, drawn back and forth between the two, and I know the one on my computer is only this big, and the one on my TV is this big, but the one that's this big is more interesting. It's, you know, maybe you saw it recently. If you haven't, look it up. It's on YouTube, but just do a Google search for Battle in Kruger Park. You may have seen it. Spectacular video of a water buffalo, a baby water buffalo. I don't know what they're called. Buffalo-ettes. Attacked by a pack of lions, the poor little baby water buffalo falls into the water, where thereupon it is attacked by a crocodile. Anyhow, watch the video. I've never seen anything on nature television remotely as riveting as that. And what's interesting too is it's so personal. It's a YouTube video. It's somebody who was there on a tour, and you know, so anybody, you know, I was on a tour at Kruger National Park about a year ago, and so it's not, you know, all of a sudden there's that connection that's there. It's like, that person was there, there's the sound, the background, it's just like I saw and I heard and all of that, except they saw this water buffalo and I didn't. So there's a much more personal connection. It's not some nice polished National Geographic with Lauren Green in the background. It's like people go, oh, I hope that little buffalo survives, and so on. Related to that first point, that first trend, is the trend toward multimedia in general. We had the text-driven web, even as recently as a few years ago with blogging and all of that, we had the text-driven web. We are now well into the multimedia web. You know, this year is certainly the year of video with YouTube and all of that. It's also the year of multimedia environments with Second Life and World of Warcraft and others. Even audio with podcasting and animations, and there's going to be much more of these. I don't know if you play these Flash games. These Flash games are horribly addictive, but again, it's like, it's multimedia. I've still got a sore wrist from shooting arrows in one of these and trying to do work, and I'm playing this little Flash game instead. But again, multimedia, the web is becoming multimedia. Web 2.0 is becoming multimedia, which means we have user-created, user-driven multimedia, and it's beginning to have an effect even on things like the game industry. People expect now, when they get a computer game, to be able to modify their computer game, to rewrite sections of the computer game, to supply their own graphics. If you look at a game like Civilization, for example, Civilization, you have Civ, and then you go online, you find Mod Civ or Civilization Mod Packs or whatever. And people do the game modding. The company that most gets this, interestingly, is Lego. And Lego has the whole Lego construction kit and all of that, and kids are doing all kinds of, they reprogram their Lego engines, they make Lego robots and things like that. If Legos could fly, kids would be making Lego bombers and things. And you know, and I'm just thinking, now I'm just thinking out loud, because, you know, we think about media, we think, okay, well, what kind of media are there? There's text, yeah, sure, okay, there's text, and then, well, what else? Audio, okay, and there's audio, and there's video, and then there's, okay, well, maybe multimedia. And the thought just occurred to me as I was talking about Legos, that the next media is actually objects. And maybe Web3, somebody was asking about that earlier, maybe Web3 is the web of objects. You know, there has been talk of the world of objects, and you know, we have RFID tags, so every object in the world can have, you know, a little tag that's broadcasting wireless information about itself. You know, hi, I'm a Kraft dinner, or whatever. I'm a pair of jeans, I'm being stolen. Stuff like that. But what if people could create their own objects with their own digital properties in those objects? I'm going to have to think about that. I think there's something to that, but I don't know what it is. Anyhow, the next trend I wanted to point to is flow. This is a really important trend. This is a trend that's been underway for a long time, but we're really beginning to see it now. My first alert to this trend was in Douglas Rushkoff's book, Siberia, where he talked about the dominant metaphor of the internet being that of surfing. And the idea of surfing is that, you know, you don't capture and hold the wave, but rather you look at the wave, you ride the wave, you go with the wave, and then the wave goes. And you know, so it's a shifting of the way of looking at online content as being static, as being like books, as being like libraries. And if you think about how so many people talk about online content, they use that kind of book, you know, book or magazine or publication or object kind of vocabulary, static objects, static web kind of vocabulary. But really what's happening more and more is that the web is about flow rather than objects. Think about instant messages or SMS, and you know, nobody saves their instant messages, at least nobody I know of saves their instant messages or their SMS. You know, you thumb into your phone, I'm at the store, and your mother doesn't save that into the vault, it's because it comes, it goes. There's a website now, you've probably heard of this website, Twitter, and what Twitter is a website where you have, I forget what it is, 144 characters or something like that, and you just enter in your 144 characters, like going to the store, or just Gladiator, or whatever. Just whatever you happen to be doing, the idea is that people, they enter it into Twitter, and then there's a group of other people, social network, remember, that follow you on Twitter, and people who are into Twitter swear by it, because now you've got this presence. You know, you know what these people, you know what these strangers are doing. I know what people are doing in Colombia. It's a very odd sort of thing. You couldn't have imagined that before. Those of you who have Facebook accounts may be seeing your Facebook status updates being used in the same way. Certainly I'm using mine in that way. And I open up Facebook, and I've got, I don't know, about 130 friends on Facebook, which is completely surprising to me, but I do. And I know what they're doing. You know, I know what a certain percentage of them are doing, because they're telling me they're updating their status. So I know that some people were out biking last week, and other people were watching movies, and other people were working. And it's the oddest thing, but I'm not saving that. It's just, that was last week, and that's what they were doing last week, and now I'm not interested anymore. And we're seeing this with the content feeds like RSS and podcasting, and even to a degree things like YouTube, and I subscribe to a feed, you know, the most viral videos, and, you know, it's like, you know, the top of the pop charts, you know, like content comes, content goes, and we're mostly not hanging on to it. And I think that changes the way we look at things like, say, learning content, or it should change how we look at learning content, because The way we have looked at learning content historically is that learning content is static. Learning content is a textbook. Learning content is a library. Learning content is a course package. But maybe learning content is more like the classes that we give. And, you know, I think about, you know, the times that I've been in a classroom, and that's pretty transient kind of stuff. Like, I go into the class and give my talk and do my resources and the questions and the answers and the exchange and the exercises and all of that. And, you know, that's not permanent. That's not something that was created, stored, and then put on a shelf and then later retrieved. It's this dynamic, fluidic interchange. And I think that is beginning to characterize online information more and will more and more characterize educational resources. It's, I have on the slide here, how do you survive in a world of constant change? And I think that people who are more and more in tune to think like Web 2.0 have the answer, and the answer is to stop thinking of things as static. It's like we have a river here in Moncton. It's kind of a muddy river, but it's a river as the river goes, and every day that river is different. It completely replaces the water in itself. And how do you deal with that? You don't think of the river as something that you have to keep a hold of. You understand the river flows. It's going to be different tomorrow than it was yesterday. Identity. Huge trends happening here, huge change happening here. We talked a bit about Facebook and a bit about people creating identities. The main idea here, I think, the main thing that is happening is that identity is being seen as personal and not institutional. And I'm not sure how to phrase that exactly. Again, I have on the slide, you own your own data, but it's not just that. To a large degree, you create your own idea, your own data. Your identity is what you create. Talking about Facebook, if Facebook is your identity, and let's suppose for the sake of argument that it is, or if your Facebook profile is your identity, well, everything you put on your Facebook profile, you put on your profile. And so on the one side of it is, okay, you need to be a little bit careful. You might not want to represent yourself as, a drunken partier who's out all night and snorts cocaine or whatever. On the other hand, you get to define your own identity. You are the one creating your Facebook profile, which is a really different sort of relationship to your identity data that you had in the past. In the past, your identity data was always held by and controlled by other people, the school, the police department, the hospital, your parents, whatever. And to a large degree, that isn't going to change, of course. All these people are still going to have bits and pieces of data related to you. But more and more, especially as privacy becomes a concern, you're going to have a larger and larger hand in creating that. Where we're seeing this actually specifically instantiated in code in the new web is in technologies like OpenID. OpenID is a protocol that allows you to have one single identity of your choosing that you can use across sites. So I can use the same identity on Facebook, MySpace, Yahoo, Google, whatever. That's where it's going to go in the future. It's not currently the case. Although a lot of these companies, including Microsoft, have signed on to it. A lot of these companies have said, yes, OpenID is where we want to go. And not simply that, they've been, and Microsoft's included in this, they've been signing patent waivers saying that we will not enforce any patents related to OpenID. Very important, because it means that it has a fighting chance now. What's significant about OpenID is not simply that you have the same identity in these multiple places, but you manage your own identity. There is no single registrar of identity. Remember Microsoft Passport? The idea of Microsoft Passport is everybody would have a Microsoft Passport and then you'd use that identity. But the problem with Microsoft Passport is that it was Microsoft's passport. Everybody had to go to Microsoft to get a passport. With OpenID, anybody, utterly anybody, can be an identity provider. You can be your own identity provider. Because in a sense, OpenID flips or turns the tables. Instead of you proving to some other person that you are who you say you are, rather, you are proving to your own satisfaction that you are unique on the other service. In other words, it's a system of self-identification rather than authentication. And that's the important difference. And so what that means is that in order to make the system work, there needs to be an incentive for people to maintain their own identity, which means it has to serve their own interest. It means that they have to have more and more control over it. So, it's going to be a couple of years before this becomes really widespread, but eventually, probably everybody will have one or more open IDs. Probably it won't be as extreme as, in Estonia, of all places, the government issued every citizen an open ID. I don't think the whole world will be that extreme, but I do believe that people will have open IDs. They'll have their preferred identity that they use. Every user who belongs to America Online has an open ID. They might not know it yet, but they have one. And I think what will happen is people will have their preferred work ID, their preferred social ID, their preferred whatever ID. They'll have different IDs for different purposes. And our understanding of what an identity is will shift a little bit. This leads to the next major trend, which I title No More Walled Gardens. And again, you look at Facebook and, in a certain sense, when you put data into Facebook, as they say, it's a one-way trip. The data goes into Facebook, it never comes out of Facebook. Well, it comes out, people can read it. But remember I was talking about these applications talking to each other REST and all of that, so one application can do a mashup with another application. Well, a lot of these social networking services don't support that yet. In other words, if I have a list of friends at Facebook, I can't simply use that list of friends on Flickr. Flickr has no way of getting that list from Facebook. But this is a temporary situation, especially if I have a single ID in Flickr and Facebook. If I have that one ID, then there's going to be a great deal of pressure on Facebook to open up, particularly since there's a website that's been releasing Facebook's source code. So I think it may be opened up whether they like it or not. That's quite...
Stephen?
Yes?
I think we're running a bit over as it is.
Okay.
I'm wondering if maybe...
We're 53, I'm sorry.
Key issue maybe or two, and then I can open the floor for discussion for a little bit because we are already over. I realize we did start the late, mind you.
Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't mean to go over. My apologies for that. The only other trend I really wanted to talk about is the personal learning environment, and basically what that is if you take personal identity and multiple providers and all of this communication back and forth and apply it to learning, you get something called the personal learning environment. And I think that if you look at these Web 2.0 applications, look at the way a lot of this stuff is rolling out on the internet, that you can see underlying principles. I call this the semantic principle. And in one sense, it's descriptive in the sense that this is what's happening, but in the other sense, it's prescriptive in the sense of if we want this kind of system to work, these are the properties these applications are going to have. And the properties are very simply, first of all, they need to support individual autonomy. People need to have the capacity to make their own decisions, to manage their own data, to make their own creations, things like that. Secondly, they need to support diversity. Rather than forcing everybody into the same thing, they need to allow people to make their own choices. And what's important is they need to allow people who have made different choices to be able to interact. Third, openness. The network needs to be open. That means that people need to be able to contribute to the network, and it also means that people need to be able to access data and information from the network. And then finally, connectivity or interactiveness. There needs to be ways for people who are in the network to communicate back and forth with each other, and so that there aren't barriers or blocks from one person communicating with another person. You see more about these in the slides, so I go on about these quite a bit more in the slides, and I've talked about these four principles in others of my talks, so if you're interested, you'll be able to find more on my website. So
I have a personal question with regard to that last comment, and then I'll pass the mic around. But for me, those elements that you just spoke of make the question, is there enough bandwidth to do this, and what is the role of an institution that traditionally has done a lot of these developmental pieces that now can be downloaded from the web? What is the role of the institution in acquiring bandwidth and controlling that even further? I think it does allow for freedom, but at the same time we're constrained by what's available, what the institution will make available, and the priorities it will place in certain elements of availability. So that's just a general comment. I don't know if you want to respond. I will pass the mic.
Bandwidth is one of these. I think there's going to be enough bandwidth, and the question will largely be who pays for it, because there's going to be a demand for bandwidth. It's not like bandwidth is always going to be expensive. I mean, fiber optics can move huge amounts of bandwidth. We work in NRC with CANET4, which is, fiber at bandwidths that are not even imaginable. So I think the bandwidth will be there. The role of the institution is much, much more interesting, because as we shift from a more group-centered to a more network-centered environment, the things that institutions do, the sorts of things that institutions do will become less valued, and indeed will become more problematic. Like one of the things institutions do really well is standardize. But in a world where diversity rather than sameness is a value, the push to standardization becomes a hindrance rather than a support. And that's just an example. Institutions are going to be facing these kind of fights. Institutions are structured typically hierarchically, not as networks. They're structured with processes of management and control in an environment where more and more is going to be important to allow people to work without managed and without being controlled. And again, so these things are going to clash. So, I can't say it quickly.
That's good for the amount of time that we take you. Any other questions or comments here? What about a resounding thank you, Stephen?
Well, thanks,
Stephen.
Thanks, everyone. Sorry I went over time.
That's okay. Thanks for taking the time to do this. And we can refer back to your slides at any time, I take it?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Downs.ca.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Have a good conference.
Thanks a lot, Steve. We have a bit of a break.